You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Nate Harrison from Brooklyn. Nate, thanks so much for being with me today.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So, Nate, let's talk about what you're working on now. I know a number of your projects, but the audience doesn't. So let's talk about what's happening now in your studio, what you're putting together.
Yeah, well, studio is actually the operative word there because my practice over the last several years, well, really since post grad school, has had to do with sort of art's relationship to intellectual property law. And as I sort of plotted along with various projects, I got more and more into kind of writing. I ended up actually doing a PhD. So actually what I'm doing right now is not anything to do with the studio per se, but I'm actually writing a book about appropriation art, generally speaking, and its relationship to intellectual property law.
Well, let's talk about that because that was your dissertation for your PhD as well, right?
Yes. Yep. Exactly.
So those are really interesting issues. Let's talk about that. So, and I know it's intellectual property in your dissertation was since 1976. Is that
Yes. Is
that how you're approaching the book as well?
Yeah. I don't know if I'm going to keep that date strictly speaking in the title, but it certainly has to do with that moment in time where there's kind of a congruent, kind of parallel history that is probably the history that some of your listeners might know, maybe you know, which is the history of sort of postmodern art, a lot of it having to do with appropriation, you know, Richard Prince, Jerry Levine, Jeff Koons, Barbara Kruger, all that kind of pictures generation of artists. But the parallel history to that is a major renovation or revision, I guess, to the U.S. copyright law, which happened in 1976. So just as kind of appropriation, copying pictures and whatnot, is becoming kind of a dominant trend, at least in the New York art world, and I would argue beyond that as well, there is also some sort of big changes going on in U.S. copyright law, so both of those kind of phenomena happen in tandem, but they will go on, I would argue, they go on to sort of shape one another going forward, you know, to up until the present and with today's sort of copy-paste culture.
So let's talk about that because it's such an issue for artists, whether, you know, copyright and in the age of, you know, Facebook and all these other platforms. And at the same time, so I'd like to talk about copyright and what did change because I don't know what changed then, but also in terms of appropriation and how artists see that. I mean, you mentioned Richard Prince and the idea of Richard Prince, which seems to feed into something about appropriation art.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you read about this, that Richard Prince said the piece that he made for Ivanka Trump is no longer his piece. And
right.
He returned the money and said, by virtue of him saying it's not his work, it's not his work. Now,
right.
It would seem that an artist who's that Ross Blechner or another artist couldn't do something like that because a painting is a painting. But, you know, so just to talk about that a little bit,
sure.
What was Richard Prince doing, actually? How can he actually say, that's no longer my work?
Well, I mean, he can say that, and he may even believe that. I think the sort of the market forces, as it were, the contemporary art world and the way that it buys and sells Richard Prince paintings won't care or not whether he disowns it or not. I think it will not lose any value if that's your criterion. I think if anything, it will gain value. So I think his gesture, I mean, don't get me wrong. I applaud any artist who will publicly denounce Trump, but I think that it's kind of a fairly safe gesture that also, by the way, pays dividends for him, right? Because, you know, historically speaking, artists, particularly appropriation artists, have always kind of been these bad boys and girls, right? They're the people that sort of flout the law, and this, in some ways, sort of further ensconces him in that narrative, right? Like, I'm so sort of renegade that I alone decide what is or is not my artwork, and it just further solidifies his reputation as this kind of, you know, maverick sort of artist, when I think actually what the case is, his practice in general is a very, you know, by today's standards, a very conservative practice. But then again, you know, he's you know, in his 60s at this point, his sort of his moment of radical practice was precisely that moment in the late 70s, early 80s.
Let's talk about copyright law, because I don't want to maybe spend too much time on Richard Prince, but even with that, the notion of his show of Instagrams of the suicide girls and what happened there, of just really just appropriating their Instagram feed, and also was a gesture that seemed to feed into today's copyright laws. But maybe we should wind that back a little bit to what happened in the 70s, as you're saying, that was the big shift in copyright law.
Yeah, absolutely. So maybe to sort of lay a foundation, the United States Copyright Law is given a thorough kind of revision in 1976. The last time it had been revised substantially before that was in 1909. So if you think about all of the sort of changes in technologies and media distribution, all those things, film, radio, television, computers, all that stuff happens between kind of 1909 and 1976. So the 1976 revision is a sort of an attempt to address all of those changes. So it does a few things. I mean, it would be much too long to get into it here, but I'll just sort of throw out a few examples. The 1976 Act gets rid of the need for artists or cultural producers or whoever you want to call it to need to register their expressions with the United States Copyright Office. So it used to be the case where if you wanted to copyright something, you actually had to formally send a letter or whatever it is to sort of let the registrar know that you are formally copyrighting this. It removed that requirement and instead said that copyright sort of is enabled the moment of fixation. So the moment you kind of draw something on a canvas or flash a camera shutter or, click a camera shutter or things like that, the expression is when it's fixed in a tangible medium, I think are the exact words, that is copyright protected. So a lot of times people make the sort of simple mistake of when they see, like, so let's say a music album or a poster or something like that, and they don't see the little, capital C with a circle around it, which denotes something's copyrighted, they think, oh, this must not be copyrighted. But that's actually not the case. That's sort of more of a courtesy that, the cliche of you doodling on a napkin at a restaurant as you're brainstorming an idea or something, that technically is copyrighted the moment you start doodling. So that's just one of the examples. Another one of the big revisions to the 1976 Act was the formal introduction of language as it pertains to fair use. So fair use is kind of a doctrine that stipulates that on certain occasions, in certain contexts, using another author's work or reprinting it, copying, appropriating, whatever you want to call it, is permissible regardless of authorization. So if I'm a book critic and I need to quote a substantial portion of a book in my book review in order to talk about that review, I don't necessarily need permission from the author to be able to reprint that portion of the book. So the law essentially recognizes that in certain cases you can copy things without authorization from the original author. That has been part of U.S. law for a long, long time, going back to the 19th century, but it was always kind of an informal, kind of judge-based sort of system. And in the 1976 Act, it sort of formally codifies that as a sort of a federal, on a federal level. So there we get fair use. And of course, as it turns out, if you kind of think from sort of the 70s and 80s up and through to even to the present, even to get back to Richard Prince really quickly, 9 times out of 10, when an appropriation artist does get sued, their sort of defense is a fair use defense. They will say something like, oh, no, but I'm allowed to use this because this qualifies as fair use because I'm doing X with this thing. I'm not just copying it for the sake of copying it or looking to simply repackage it, which you would otherwise call piracy or something like that, but I'm commenting on it. I'm adding something to it. I'm now making an artwork out of it, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm sorry, go on, yeah.
I was just simply going to say that maybe to talk about your example of Richard Prince on Instagram, that's a really huge case because, as you probably know, and maybe some of your listeners know, that's the case where Richard Prince is essentially appropriating wholesale other Instagram accounts, like pictures off of other people's Instagram accounts. And he's really not doing much other than screen capturing the Instagram off of a phone or a tablet or whatever it is. And then he enlarges them to these big canvases, like maybe 3 feet by 4 feet canvases. He does add his little comment at the bottom, but he's really just kind of reprinting it wholesale. And that's essentially, at least in my mind, and granted, I'm not a lawyer, but I've studied a lot about this kind of stuff. That's a real huge question. Is that enough of a change to constitute fair use? And so I think that's a really great example of just how malleable fair use is when an artist can essentially pilfer other people's creative work and call it his own. I mean, that to me is the flip side of him disowning the Ivanka Trump picture. It's almost like him saying, just by virtue of him putting his name on it, I'm Richard Prince, and therefore this is art, or this is acceptable, this is fair use, I think is a really interesting case.
Well, didn't also Sherry Levine do that when I remember images of Dorothea Lange that she appropriated? And if I'm not mistaken, they were, these were 8x10 images, photographs, vintage prints that Sherry Levine then re-photographed and framed at I think the exact same size. It almost looked virtually indistinguishable from the original.
Yeah, she did that with a lot of different photographers. She may have done it with Dorothea Lange. I know that for certain she did it with Edward Weston, if only because I've written a lot about that. But it's the same difference, right? So for the most part, I mean, you could argue that, but let's just say for the sake of argument that it is the same, more or less the same thing. She absolutely just sort of essentially took and just essentially re-photographed photographs from Edward Weston, right, and represented them as her own work. That probably, back in the day, would not have flown in court. She would have been found, liable for copyright infringement. But maybe not today. I don't know. The law has kind of gone through some changes itself, or at least not the law so much, but the way the law has been interpreted has gone through lots of changes. At that time in the late 70s, early 80s, although, we kind of treat Sherry Levine art historically as kind of a radical artist, and I don't dispute that, she was at the same time not exactly Mrs. Moneybags. So she got a few, I think, kind of cease and desist letters. At the time, she moved on to other projects. It kind of, went off the radar. She's still celebrated by the art world for that kind of radical gesture. But I think there is a difference, and that is, I think just from the point of view of critique, right, if we understand that sort of generally speaking, art is supposed to be some sort of critical statement or something, I think she very purposely chose Edward Weston to kind of, for lack of a better way to say it, a kind of crude way, say the middle finger to kind of the patriarchy of modernist photography or something like that, right? Like, yes, I'm going to take your image and claim it as my own, right? That's a little bit different than, I think, Richard Prince, who's kind of, well, let me put it this way. That sort of gesture by Levine was kind of generally seen as a kind of a gesture against authorship, right? To sort of reject authorship. And I think that in Richard Prince's case, there's almost kind of a reverse, where he's not sort of rejecting authorship so much as he's kind of embracing his soul authorship or something. Like, he's the kind of the romantic author par excellence, which is to say that he, like I said before, almost kind of has the Midas touch, where he kind of, like, whatever he touches becomes art, right? So I don't really think he's meant doing it as a kind of a critique. He's just simply doing it because he can do it, because at this point, Richard Prince is very wealthy, he is established, he is kind of known as the bad boy in contemporary art, and he's a brand. I mean, he's a brand, so he's essentially a kind of a branding strategy, almost, if I can be cynical about it.
Right, right. No, I think that's accurate. And I think also, I mean, Sherry Levine and her photographing of photographs also seem to be about an issue of photography, which is, right, photography takes images, right? It's in many ways about stealing images. You take a photograph of a building, you take a photograph of a sculpture, you've in a sense stolen that, just as if you've taken a portrait. So, I mean, I always thought that Sherry Levine had a lot of you could give her a break because she was stealing another image, and that's what photography is in a sense. But like you're saying, Richard Prince is in a different arena, not only because it's not about that photographic issue, but also because he is this, so to speak, brand, and the money involved is much, much greater.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, Sherry Levine is, thoroughly embedded within this kind of larger critique, precisely what you said, this critique of photography, the notion that somehow there's a kind of an originality, uniqueness to photography when it is, by its very mechanical nature, as you point out, a kind of a derivative practice unto itself. And I think at that time, that's kind of where the discourse of of kind of photography was, is kind of the celebration of modernist photography, of these sort of genius artists who, by the way, 99% of the time were male, white males. And so I think that she was just trying to kind of, you know, deflate that a little bit. And I think she was also, just as a side note, she was kind of being influenced by a lot of the kind of the critical literature around her at the time, like October Magazine, a lot of post-structuralist theory and stuff like that. So she, I think she comes at it from kind of a very intellectual place. I know Richard Prince, just because he said it on the record, he's kind of anti-intellectual. He doesn't believe in any of that stuff. He thinks kind of theorizing art is a misplaced endeavor. And so, yeah, I think that he's just kind of doing this to sort of celebrate his, you know, whatever it is, his creative whim, let's say that.
Right. And so to bring us up to the present day, the 90s, the last decade, now, you know, copyright is a different, or has more issues, perhaps, or slightly different. Take the things when artists are posting images on Facebook all the time, and there's this sense of could they just be stolen, reprinted, reused? I mean, what do you think about that? And will the book be talking about that? Like, what does that mean now for artists to be? I hear that question a lot. Like, you know, should we not put images on the internet because they can so easily be stolen? I mean, in terms of that question, and by stolen meaning, you know, that their copyright can be infringed upon. How do you see that?
I would look at it through a few different lenses, and that is, number one, copyright law itself, which, just as the 1976 Act meant to kind of revise a decades-old copyright act or, you know, law in place, so too now in 2017, I think the 1976 Act looks a little dated, right? It needs kind of a revision. There have been a couple, you know, kind of add-ons, and the DMCA Act of 1998, the Sonny Bono Copyright Extension Act of 1988. They've added a few more things over the years, but even right now, I think it's the 115th Congress right now is in the beginning stages of introducing, and this will take years, but introducing yet another kind of overhaul of the Copyright Act, because I think that everybody understands that in the 21st century, in this ubiquity of file sharing and copying, and the fluidity with which digital images flow, this needs a new address, right? So there's that. And to swing back to art, you know, if anything, I think that the pictures generation, you know, a lot of times is celebrated as kind of this, you know, after pop art, they are sort of the movement that really naturalizes the idea of cultural production being derivative, and to work with copies is acceptable. And I think that at that time, that was kind of a radical practice. I think now that has filtered down into just sort of mainstream cultural activity, right? I mean, I would place money betting that you copy things, I copy things, everybody copies things all the time, whether it's for art or not. We just live in a society, every time we write an email and we kind of forward an email to a friend, you are kind of in essence copying something, right? So we it's almost impossible to live in the world, at least, you know, in the United States, and if you're computer enabled and all that stuff, it's almost impossible for you not to engage in some sort of that copying activity on a daily basis. So we're living in this kind of, like, we're immersed rather in this sort of culture of the copy everywhere. So the way that I look at it in terms of art practice is that it's less to do with legality and more to do with ethics. And that's kind of a flimsy word at the moment, or at least kind of a vague word, because you could spend a long time sort of defining that. But I think that precisely because there is this ease with which you can copy, artists who are traditionally tasked with kind of examining the world, right, have the burden of having to have a kind of an ethics about how they do that. And maybe that's what rubs me the kind of the wrong way about Richard Prince, because he kind of seems to lack kind of an ethics about what he's doing, or a smartness, or a consideration, or a sensitivity, maybe you could call it that, right? But that's what, kind of where I go is because copying is so prevalent, there is the chance you could be, you know, sued and whatnot, but that's just, that pales in comparison to the speed with which we copy. Really, I think it comes down to kind of an ethics question. I also teach. I'm a professor up in Boston, and that's what I'm always trying to instill in my students, is to just really think about what they're copying, why they're copying it, how does that affect the person that you're copying, how does it affect you, would you be okay if somebody copied from you? I'm a big believer in fair use. I'm a big believer in copying, but I'm not a big believer in this kind of image anarchy. I do believe actually in copyright law. I believe there should be a copyright law. So just to educate people about how that actually works.
So then, I mean, to bring it down to just the issue of then watermarking, because that's something people do. Does that make any sense for people who have I have a friend who has an incredible following, a photographer on Instagram, does gorgeous images from Amsterdam, these kind of landscapes, but they look particularly luscious and engaging on Instagram.
Yep.
Lately, he's been watermarking them because he said people, you know, he gets photo of the day and all these awards all the time. And he said people can just snap his photo from a screenshot, post it, and they'll start getting awards based on his work. I mean,
yeah.
What do you think about that? How does that enter into this? And does watermarking really stop anything? Because, of course, they can crop out his watermark. We can find ways through Photoshop to remove watermarks.
Yeah, I think maybe two things. And one is, you know, I hate to say it, I think that sort of commercial photographers or photographers that, you know, make a living, not necessarily in the art world per se, although there can be some crossover, but, you know, commercial photographers that make their living through selling and licensing images, I think they're bearing a lot of the brunt of this. And I completely understand their frustration and their anxiety when they talk about their images being, you know, appropriated all the time. And it's hard enough living, hard enough to make a living being a photographer, let alone having to worry about like people taking your images all the time. So there is that side of it, right? That was the argument for the Patrick Carreyrou, right? Who was the artist a few years ago who sued Richard Prince, but ultimately Richard Prince prevailed in that, for the most part prevailed in that case. Carreyrou v. Prince. So there's that side of it. There's like, I definitely sympathize with the sort of the plight of the enterprising photographer who like wants to hold on to their stuff, because otherwise if you don't watermark it, right, you open the floodgates and you essentially say like, yeah, anybody can kind of take it. There's no repercussions. There's that part of it. The other part of it is, as you say, right, like you could find a way to crop out the watermark, or you could find a hack to remove the watermark. There's always a hack. There's always a workaround. There's always been a workaround. It might not be right now. It might take a while, but people eventually figure out how to get around the limitations, right? So the watermarking, I think, is a kind of a short-term measure that I have mixed feelings about, but I also think it belongs in that category, and it's the same thing with, like, cable television content scrambling or, you know, any one of these kind of measures, or, you know, digital encryption, right? It's like any one of these measures that takes – it sort of treats – viewers and would-be appropriators as already criminals in a sense, right? It says, like, we're not going to let the law deal with this. We're not going to let you sort of appropriate this, and then we'll take you to court. We're just going to skip that whole part of it. We're just going to lock you out, right? And so it just kind of treats everybody as kind of a would-be criminal, and I don't know. I don't like that either, right? I think maybe just to return back to copyright, I do think that the copyright laws are the proper place to address that. Now, it's easy for me to say that because I don't have as much skin in the game as maybe your friend does, right? So, you know, it takes time and money for him to pursue people, to send cease and desist letters, to hire lawyers, you know, to kind of, you know, intimidate other people. But I just think that the watermarking thing is just an invitation for hackers to subvert it in the long run.
So ultimately, in this, you know, moment that we're in of sharing all the time and in terms of copyright, artists have to continue to share what they share. There shouldn't be a reason to be afraid to share or post or put images on a variety of social media.
Yeah, I mean, it really gets into thorny territory because I think it depends on how you define artist, right? I mean, I think there's this kind of cliche of the artist. It's kind of this freewheeling spirit and it's kind of maybe left-leaning in their political tendencies, and they, like, would like to share, and they would like to receive other people sharing with them, and it's kind of all hunky-dory, and we all hold hands and sing Kumbaya, and it's all good. But there are a lot of artists, right, who are very interested in protecting their work, especially, again, if you happen to be an artist. You know, let me give you a good example, right? What's her name? I'll give you another one. Susan Mizellas, right, Magna photographer, very celebrated photographer, kind of hovers in between kind of photojournalist and kind of art world person. I would say that she's more in the photojournalist realm. She would describe herself as an artist, I think. But she doesn't at the same time operate necessarily in the kind of the blue chip art world that, say, somebody like Sherry Levine or Richard Prince does. She absolutely wants to protect her images. She wants to protect her images, though, not so much because she's losing money per se, but she believes because she is a photojournalist that she's trying to kind of, in a sense, protect the integrity of the subjects that she photographs. So for her to take pictures and then just have an artist kind of come along, decontextualize them, and treat them in a kind of what she would think is a cavalier way, is in a sense a disservice to the people that she photographs, right? A few years ago, actually about 10 years ago, the New York painter Joy Garnett appropriated one of Susan Mizellis' photographs. She found it on the internet. She didn't even know it was a Susan Mizellis photograph. She actually even found a cropped version of the photograph. She just found it kind of in a vacuum, in a sense, right on the internet. And she's like, oh, cool. And so she kind of made a painting based off that. And Susan Mizellis caught wind of it eventually and didn't like that. But I don't think that she really had a problem with the fact that it was, you know, had a problem with it maybe costing her money or something, is that the photograph that Joy appropriated was actually a picture of a fighter throwing a Molotov cocktail at like a government building in Nicaragua in the 1970s, right? And this is to say that Susan Mizellis spent a long time in Nicaragua documenting like rebel movements and risking her life and seeing people being killed. And there's a kind of a heaviness, a weightiness, a reality behind those photographs for her. And so for her to see those just kind of get decontextualized and serve up as like the latest, you know, postmodern artwork du jour, I think was kind of the affront, right? It was kind of like, you're doing this kind of very real situation in Nicaragua a disservice, right? So there's that angle of it too. Maybe this is just a long-winded way of saying that I think artists kind of come to this stuff in a lot of different ways.
Right, and that does also come down to the ethics of the situation in terms of
exactly.
What you're saying and how it's being
exactly.
used, because that reminds me of also Shepard Fairey using the Obama image, and there was a similar argument regarding that, right? It was a photojournalist that had taken that image that he wasn't aware of or seemed not to be,
yep.
and then there was an issue with that. So, I mean, although we can't make, you know, I do continue to post things on the internet, images of my own and others, and
mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't want to make a moral to this interview, but is there any kind of rules that you think artists should be aware of when posting their own work on the internet? I mean, I know some are more sensitive than others, like the examples you mentioned, but is there anything that you think or your book might suggest that we should be more aware of when posting our work or not in the coming years?
Yeah, I don't think that there's any necessarily kind of one way to look at it. But you know what? Maybe this is kind of a poetic answer, which is to say I had a friend of mine give me a painting, actually, of an artist friend of mine give me a painting a couple years ago for my birthday. And it's a really simple and beautiful painting. It just has this one sentence on it, and it says, copy the work of other artists as you would want them to copy you. Right? And so I think that maybe that's what I do to my students and other artists that I talk to, is if you just think about if you yourself were appropriated, right, how would you feel about that? I think that we feel fine about the notion of copying, because the reality is for a lot of people, no one copies them, right? Maybe because you're a young and fledgling artist, you're maybe not quite on the scene yet. Maybe your works don't sell for tons of money or something like that, so you're okay with copying. I'm speaking maybe of kind of like millennial, you know, younger art students and whatnot, but, you know, because they copy all the time. But if they took a step back and think like, oh, okay, well, you put yourself in the shoes of your friend who takes the landscapes, or in the shoes of somebody like the Suicide Girls, or any number of these photographers. There's actually a photographer suing Richard Prince right now for one of the Instagram photos. Put yourself in their shoes. Like, if you kind of work hard to produce these images and then someone comes along and appropriates them, not that that's wrong per se. Again, I encourage appropriation. I encourage copying. I love appropriation art. But just to do it in a smart way, to actually maybe do it in a way that engages in a dialogue with that artwork, and maybe even with that artist, maybe even email that artist, say, hey, you know, I really like your picture. You know, I'd like to use it for something. You know, they can say no, and maybe you could appropriate it anyway. At least you'd have established a dialogue, and you could even present that in a court of law saying, hey, you know what, I try to engage, and this is my idea. And that's kind of the sensitivity that I'm talking about, this kind of ethics of just like being smart about what you're doing. And even to the point where maybe you decide, you know what, I'm not going to do this. Or on the flip side, saying, you know what, now I'm emboldened even more. I have an even better idea because I have engaged with this artist or engaged with their work in a smart way. I know the history of this work. I know kind of what it's about, and this is what I want to bring to it. You know, that kind of line of questioning. And I think a lot of artists do that, but I think a lot of artists don't. And I think especially because we live in such a, you know, we live in a society where copying is so easy. And especially as, you know, younger people are growing up. You know, I've got students who only know the world as an internet-enabled world, right? They were 2 years old when the internet started, so they've only known the ability to copy. And so copying is like second nature to them, and they don't even think about it. And I guess what I'm saying is simply think about it.
It's great talking to you about these issues. I'm so glad we discussed this and look forward to your book coming out. But before we go, I wanted to ask what you are reading now. It could be off-topic or anything, but if you want to mention a book that you're reading.
Sure. I'm embarrassed to say that just within the past, you know, month since Trump was elected president, I cannot stop watching the news. I'm just glued to the television. So I haven't been reading as much as I want to. But I will say this. I have one of my other friends who's in academia in Chicago, kind of in response to the election, uploaded what he called the emergency reader. And it was just actually, this gets into copying again. He actually uploaded about 100 PDFs of just various chapters of books and articles and just essential readings that he had compiled along with asking his friends to contribute to it, including myself. I uploaded some things or I gave them to him to upload. And it's essentially just a reader, a big compendium, if you will, of writings having to do with politics and aesthetics and art and how do we think about art in the age of Trump, but particularly geared for people who teach in universities. How do art historians respond to what's going on politically? How do studio artists working in art schools respond? Like, how do politically conscious people who are also involved in art and cultural production respond to what's going on? So he put together this reader. It includes Hannah Arendt and Bruno Latour and, you know, readings from all over the place, from sociology, art history, literary theory, political theory, economics, all sorts of stuff, all compiled into one sort of PDF or compendium of PDFs. And so I've been reading that with my wife. But that's kind of what I've been doing is doing my own writing, being glued to the television and social media and trying to keep abreast of just how much our world is changing right now and how art can affect that change.
Well, thanks. I'm glad you mentioned that, and hopefully I can put a link to some of those compendium of PDFs. That sounds like a fascinating set of reading. I want to thank you for talking with me tonight. It's really been a pleasure, and wish you the best on your book.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me, Brainerd.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.